Every night, for fun, the store workers switch all the prices around. Plus, no matter which computer you say you want to buy, they just go back into the storeroom and grab the first one they come to, because they know you'll never be able to tell the difference. What's your name gonna do? They say to each other, just out of earshot. First they count the megabytes. So, when you buy from one of these stores, you really need to know what you're doing. Before you go to the store, get a piece of paper and make up a specifications sheet detailing exactly what you want in terms of RAM, ROM, processor speed, hard drive, modem, keyboard, monitor, and physical configuration. When you get to the store, find a salesperson who appears to know what he's doing, crumple your specification sheet into a ball, toss it into the air, and whichever computer system it lands nearest to, say, "I'll take that one." Be sure to ask about the auto defrost option. If you don't want to deal with a store, you can purchase your computer via mail order. If you look in the back pages of any computer magazine, you'll see dozens of very aggressive advertisements for discount mail order companies offering great prices on computers. At least, I think they're computers. The actual merchandise being offered in these advertisements is always listed in print as approximately 2 molecules high. And even if you can read the words, you can't necessarily understand them because they appear to be written in some kind of secret code. So you can definitely get some great deals from computers or else. Discounts, discounts, discounts. Take a look at these incredible prices. Mail order companies. Although it could turn out that you have unintentionally purchased, say, a lawn tractor or undeveloped vacation property in Bosnia. Even if you get an actual computer, things may not work out perfectly. I once purchased a laptop computer from a major, highly successful discount mail order company that is known for running elaborate multi-page advertisements in computer magazines. These are fun theme ads featuring people, I assume they're company employees, dressed up as secret agents, big game hunters, and so on, actually wildly excited about this company's computers. So I figured, hey, a company running all these big, expensive ads has to be good, right? So I called up the company and spoke to an enthusiastic young man with a name like Todd, who called me David a lot and who confirmed that this particular computer was a superb product. And so figuring that there was no reason why a close personal first name basis friend like Todd would lie to me, I ordered it. And I have to say that this computer did, in fact, function beautifully, provided that the sole activity you planned to use it for was setting your drink on it. But as far as actual computing was concerned, it had a couple of problems. The two main ones being, one, it usually refused to turn on. Two, if you did get it to turn on, it would wait until you had written something, for example, a humor column that was due that very day. And then when you tried to save it, the computer, sensing that you were about to actually accomplish something, would turn itself off, and your humor column would go to that big hard drive in the sky, and you would never see it again. So, I called the technical support hotline number. I expected a long wait, but I was pleasantly surprised when I was immediately answered by a courteous, efficient, and highly knowledgeable recorded voice informing me that all the technical support representatives were busy. The voice did not say what they were doing. My guess is they were selecting their costumes for the magazine ads. It turned out that reaching an actual technical support representative was about as easy as reaching the Pope. The difference being that if you ever did reach the Pope, he would probably be more helpful. The representative I finally spoke to, after maybe 17 years on hold, basically took the position that, one, there was no problem, and two, it was my fault. I don't blame him. As a technical support representative, he had probably spent most of his career dealing with computer illiterates who cannot understand why their computer stopped working just because they inserted a slice of processed cheese into the disk drive. It's only natural that he has come to assume that everybody who calls him up is an idiot. Technical support representative.
What seems to be the problem?
Me. Well, for one thing, the computer won't turn on. Technical support representative, suspiciously.
Oh, what do you mean? The computer won't turn on.
Me. I mean, the computer won't turn on. Technical support representative.
I see. Did you press the power switch?
Me. Yes. Technical support representative, accusingly.
Oh, it should turn on.
Me. Yes. Technical support representative.
Are you sure you pressed the power switch?
Me. Yes. Technical support representative.
The one on the computer.
Me. Yes. Technical support representative.
And it won't turn on?
Me. No. Technical support representative becoming annoyed.
Well, it should.
This went on for quite a while, with the technical support representative grilling me courtroom style, grinding away relentlessly, looking for cracks in my story, trying to get me to break down and admit that my computer was in fact working fine, that I had just made up this whole wacky episode so that I could wait forever on hold in hopes of someday experiencing the ultimate pleasure of talking to a technical support representative. Finally, he gave up, and reluctantly gave me a secret code authorization number that I could use to ship the computer back to the company, which then took several weeks to, and I'm sure this wasn't easy, but that's why these big operations have quality control departments. Locate and send me a computer that had exactly the same problem as the first one. As it turned out, this was not a serious setback, because 2 days later, my community was struck by Hurricane Andrew. I can't prove that this was deliberately caused by technical support, but I have my suspicions. So, for the next 6 weeks, I didn't have any electricity. By the time it got turned back on, that particular computer was, of course, absurdly outmoded, and I needed a new one anyway. So it all worked out fine, the point being that you should not hesitate to purchase your computer via mail order, or you can just mail some money directly to me, and I'll take care of everything. What do I do when I get my new computer to my home or office? 1. Position the computer exactly where you plan to use it. Sit in front of it in the chair you plan to use. Ask yourself, is the keyboard comfortable to type on? Is the monitor clearly visible? Can you easily reach the controls? If the answer to these questions is no, the computer is probably still in the box. 2. Remove the computer from the box. There should be several large pieces of packing foam that will never fit back into the box again. Federal law requires that you save these forever and have them buried with you in your casket. In addition, the box should contain some cables, several warranty cards, 3 or 4 manuals, and a minimum of 8 pieces of paper that say, "Important, read this first." If the shipping and receiving department is really on the ball, the box will also contain a computer divided into several pieces. 3. Using the cables, connect the computer pieces together, then plug everything in and turn on the power switch. 4. Install all of your software following the instructions in Chapter 10. You fool. 5. Now everything will work perfectly. 6. Ha ha, just kidding. Now you will be in new computer hell, trying to get all of your programs to work together, which is like achieving permanent peace in the Middle East, but less likely to occur in your lifetime. There is no end to the ways in which computer programs can screw each other up. I regularly read internet user groups filled with messages from people trying to solve software incompatibility problems that, in terms of complexity, make the U.S. tax code look like Dr. Seuss. A typical exchange of messages goes like this. Windows problem. I'm wondering if anybody can help me with the problem I'm having with my computer at work. I recently upgraded to Windows 95 from Windows 3.1416, and I've noticed that when I'm running WordWanker version 2.0.9.4, which I upgraded from 1.8.4.7 in conjunction with FaxBuddy version 4.2.4.37857, well, everything works fine for about the first 25 minutes, but then if I type a subordinating conjunction followed by any form of the verb foment, the keyboard locks up permanently and the hard drive makes a whimpering sound, and all current data is erased, including data and computers several cubicles away. I've tried everything, including reformatting my hard drive and exorcism. Please help. Reply to Windows problem.
I had exactly the same problem, and after a lot of trial and error, I found out that if you click on the Windows Control Panel, then on Command Center, then on Reset Variables, and then Establish New Parameters, then on Define Standards, then on Modify Criteria, then on Effectuate Paradigms, then on the little icon that says Do Not Ever Click on this little icon, and then go down to the box that says Enter New Value, and type in 2038, you will still have the same problem. This is why I started using heroin. And so it goes in the user groups, endless, increasingly poignant discussions of problems that the human mind was never designed to grapple with. Of course, your experience could be totally different. You might find that everything works exactly the way it's supposed to. No problems, no glitches, nothing. In which case, 7. Whatever you do, don't wake up. Chapter 4, Becoming Computer Literate, or Words for Nerds. The computer world has a language all its own, just like Hungary. The difference being that if you hang around with Hungarians long enough, you eventually start to understand what they're talking about, whereas the language used in the computer world is specifically designed to prevent this from happening. Nevertheless, there are certain basic computer terms that you need to try to familiarize yourself with so that when you go to purchase a computer, you don't sound like some random putz. Instead, you'll sound like a specific putz who memorized some terms out of a book. Basic computer terms. Hardware. This is the part of the computer that stops working when you spill beer on it. Software. These are the programs that you put on the hard drive by sticking them through the little slot. The function on the software is to give instructions to the CPU, which is a set of three initials inside the computer that rapidly processes billions of tiny facts called bytes, and within a fraction of a second sends you an error message that requires you to call Technical Support Hotline, which is located on the planet Gazambo. Software is usually accompanied by documentation in the form of big, fat, scary manuals that nobody ever reads. In fact, for the past 5 years, most of the manuals shipped with software products have actually been copies of Stephen King's The Stand with new covers pasted on. Megahertz. This is a really, really big hertz. RAM. This is a shorthand way of referring to ROM. The unit of measurement for RAM is the meg, which stands for a certain amount of RAM. The function of RAM is to give guys a way of deciding whose computer has the biggest, studliest, most tumescent memory. This is important because with today's complex software, the more memory a computer has, the faster it can produce error messages. So the bottom line is, if you're a guy, you cannot have enough RAM. Bill Gates currently has over 743 billion megs of RAM, and he still routinely feels the need to stuff a zucchini in his underwear. You should use the preceding terms whenever you have to interface. Everyone involved should wear a condom. With computer experts. For example, if you're purchasing a new computer, you want to use as many of these terms as possible, so the store personnel will realize that they're dealing with a person who has a high level of technical expertise. Store personnel. May I help you? You.
Well, I'm looking for a hard drive with plenty of RAM in the megahertz.
Store personnel. Oh, you want the computer store next door. This is a supermarket. You.
Well, let me see your zucchini.
Once you get your computer home, of course, you will no longer need to use technical terms, but you will want to familiarize yourself with the following. Computer terms that you will actually use once you get the computer home from the store. Uh-oh. What the hell happened to my report? I need that report. Pounding on the computer.
Give me back my report or I'm going to throw your little friend the fax machine out the window.
Wait. The screen is saying something. BIOS ROM Auto Cache Format Error.
That's helpful. I'll call the technical support hotline.
After 173 minutes on hold listening to Tom Jones sing What's New Pussycat,
I'll read the manual. Who wrote this thing? The Internal Revenue Service? Okay, here it is. Page 367.
A BIOS ROM AutoCache Format Error. Message indicates that there is an error in the BIOS ROM AutoCache Format.
That clears that up. Jason, could you help Daddy, please? Daddy can't get the computer to give Daddy back his report. Yes, Jason, Daddy knows you're watching Power Rangers, but this is really, really important. Jason! Damn it, Jason, if you don't help Daddy get his report out of the computer right now, Daddy's going to spend the rest of his corporate life cleaning urinals.
No, don't cry, Jason. Daddy's sorry. Listen, if you help Daddy get his report back, Daddy will buy you a motorcycle, okay?
Yes, a real one. That's right, Jason. It says BIOS ROM AutoCache Format Error.
Yes, Jason, Daddy is a big duty head to make an error like that. But how can Daddy get his... What are you doing, Jason? Are you sure you know... Hey, there it is, Daddy's report.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you.
Okay, a red motorcycle, but you can't tell Mommy.
Chapter 5, Comdex. Nerdstock in the desert, or Bill Gates is Elvis. In researching this book, two of my most important goals, not necessarily in order of importance, were, one, to ascertain the long-term direction in both technological and market strategy of the computer industry. Two, to lose money in slot machines. And thus, in the fall of 1995, I went to Las Vegas to attend an event called Comdex. Comdex is the world's largest computer trade show, and the largest such show of any kind in the United States. It's a massive, sprawling gathering of over 200,000 people seeking new ways to realize the full potential of the information revolution, by which I mean make money. Everybody who is anybody in the computer world goes to Comdex. It is Geek-O-Rama. It is Nerdstock. It is also so huge that by the time I made my lodging arrangements, all the first-class hotels were booked, as were the second, third, and fourth through 163rd class hotels, as well as many of the cleaner dumpsters. So I wound up staying in an establishment that, in an effort to avoid costly litigation, I will refer to here as the Total Lack of Quality Inn, not its real name. All the faucets dripped, the bed was pre-rumpled for your convenience, and the toilet paper was stiff enough to be used for bridge repair. I did not see cockroaches, but I believe that this was only because my room was not up to their sanitation standards. My room did, however, feature a TV set. And while I was unpacking, I turned it on, and there he was, Bill Gates. It was a replay of a speech Gates had given earlier that day to a standing-room-only crowd. To the Comdex attendees, Bill Gates is Elvis. Gates was talking about his vision of the software of the future, and he was illustrating his points with an elaborate movie that cost at least as much as Waterworld, but with way better acting. The movie, which was set in the near future, told a story of a small town where a charming old resort was closing down. Some people wanted developers to take over and modernize the resort. Some wanted to preserve it as a historical site. It was a classic human conflict, and the characters resolved it via the mechanism that has been used to resolve dramatic conflicts since the Shakespearean era. Software. These people had software that kicked butt. For one thing, it looked really cool. For another thing, it enabled people to talk to their computers. Actually, I talk to my computer now. Sometimes I call it bad names and threaten to put it in the dishwasher. The difference is that the computers in the Microsoft movie understood. A person would say, "Get me the Fuberman contract." And the computer, with a flourish of cool futuristic graphics, would produce the contract and then say something Jeeves-like, such as, "Would you like to see more documents on this topic?" Or, "Shall I schedule the meeting for 3 p.m. Friday?" Or, "You really ought to trim that nasal hair."
The computers didn't actually make that last statement, but they definitely had the capability. I think this talking computer thing is highly significant. If we start talking to our computers, we're eventually going to develop personal relationships with them. They'll become our office buddies. We'll start telling them jokes. Human. So, the guy says to the woman, "Oh, then it must be your feet." Get it? It must be your feet. The computer. "I already know that joke." Human. "Oh." Computer. "I know 583 million jokes." The big question I have about talking computers is, who's going to program them? I raise this question because a lot of programmers are young guys, which means they might be good at understanding computers, but might not have developed the social skills necessary to tell a computer how to talk to humans, especially female humans. Human. "Hello, computer. My name is Jane." Computer. "Hello, Jane. That is a nice set of garbanzas." But getting back to the Microsoft movie, after a number of plot developments, the various characters were able, using software, to resolve their conflicts. And at the end, everything worked out when the entire town was purchased by Bill Gates, who tore everything down to make room for his vacation home and attached 6,000-car garage. No, I'm kidding. The movie had a happy ending thanks to software, and I was feeling a warm glow of hope about the future of computing that stayed with me all the way to the hotel lobby, where I found out that it was impossible to get a cab to Comdex because all the cabs in Las Vegas were already occupied by people trying to get to or from Comdex. So, I walked to the convention center. This took me quite some time because Las Vegas, being in the middle of a desert, is basically a giant optical illusion, wherein no matter where you're standing, all the major hotels and attractions appear to be close. Whereas, in fact, they are great distances away, sometimes actually in Mexico. But I had no choice. I walked and walked, cursing at the cabs whizzing past filled with Comdex people. As I walked, stepping over the skeletons of tourists who had died while attempting to walk in Las Vegas during the summer, I thought about how much better things would be in the future when, in a situation like this, I'd have a tiny but sophisticated computer which, using the software of tomorrow with its sophisticated speech capabilities, would curse at the cabs for me. Finally, I reached the convention center where I got my official badge and joined the vast, bustling nerd throng. If I had to give you a brief description of Comdex, drawing on my years of experience as a professional observer and writer skilled in the use of language, I would describe it as big. There were hundreds and hundreds of swoopy, snazzy displays featuring every manner of attention-getting device, big signs, flashing lights, loud sounds, an actual waterfall, giveaway items such as hats, t-shirts, pens, and actual Corvettes, a magician, Olympic gymnast, a guy dressed as an armadillo, women dressed as women without a lot of clothes on, and so on. There were also big-name celebrities. One booth, for example, had a sign saying that at 3 p.m., there would be a personal appearance by, I swear, Lenny Sharkey, bus driver for Bon Jovi and Whitney Houston. Many booths had smooth-talking, microphone-wearing, extremely outgoing people pretending to be wildly enthusiastic about things like modems. They were constantly trying to lure crowds into their booth areas to watch product demonstrations. It reminded me a lot of those people you see at fairs selling cutlery. The guys who are always cutting nails in half with steak knives and using a kitchen gizmo to cut a tomato so that it looks like a flower. The guys who always tell you how easy this is, except that when you try it at home, you wind up with a tomato that looks as though it was attacked by crazed rodents. The Comdex people give the same kind of demonstrations, except that instead of cutlery, they're selling computer products. But the key is, it always worked. I will tell you from harsh personal experience that back on the planet Earth, a lot of computer products, I would say a majority, do not work properly the first time you try them. Some products never work, or work so badly that you find yourself wishing you were a terrorist so that you could have access to the kind of explosives you'd need to convert these products into subatomic particles. But on the planet Comdex, everything always works great. All the software, all the hardware does exactly what it's supposed to do. Mainly, it gives you information. Tons of it. Billions and billions of pieces of it. The underlying philosophy of Comdex, never disputed, is that you cannot have too much information. Everywhere you look at Comdex, information is spewing out at you in vivid color and stereo sound. From hundreds of monitors and speakers, big and small, information, communications, the future, free pens. The thing is, I'm not sure I'm ready for more information. I'm already surrounded by way more information than I could absorb in what little time I have left after performing essential daily activities such as eating, sleeping, working, laundry, and trying to locate my keys. For example, I have yet to read any of the manuals for my major appliances. I read only about 15%. The comic sports Dear Abby in the celebrity tidbit column where they tell you things like whom Roseanne is currently pregnant by. Of my daily newspaper, I can barely keep track of even the most basic facts about American life, such as what city the Cleveland Browns are currently playing in. And forget about foreign affairs. The other day, for example, I heard a guy on the radio saying that there were riots in a place called Jakarta, and I thought to myself, I wonder where the hell that is. It could be anywhere. It could be in one of my major appliances. I just don't have time to find out. But if the Comdex people are right, I better get ready to receive way more information, because there are going to be all these swoopy new data-spewing gizmos on the market, and if I don't embrace them, if I don't let them make my life easier, then I'm going to be in some deep cyber duty. I stopped to watch one guy demonstrate a product that offered, I think that's what the guy said, interactive voice and text technology. The demonstration featured a little movie. Nowhere near as elaborate as the Bill Gates movie, but still a quality production, about two neighbors, Fred and Frank, who are competing for the same big contract. The difference is that one of them, Frank, I think, is hip to the interactive voice and text technology, whereas Fred is not. Also, Frank has more hair. As the movie starts, Fred and Frank come out of their homes, exchange some good-natured banter about who'll get the big contract, and then hop into their respective cars and head for work. The difference is that Frank, using interactive voice and text technology on his car phone, is able to talk to a computer, which enables him to be an extremely busy bee, returning calls, revising contract specifications, scheduling meetings, and just generally being a fountain of productivity until he rear-ends a school bus. No, really, Frank is somehow able to handle big, huge wads of information while driving, in stark contrast to Fred, who has nothing in his car but a plain old low-tech briefcase filled with the prehistoric medium of paper which Fred paws inefficiently through on the way to work. It's even worse at Fred's office, where we see that his desk is a vast, festering paper jungle. Plus, he has a regular old dopey phone. Meanwhile, Frank, whose desk looks like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, clicks efficiently away at his computer and calmly gives instructions to his high-tech telephone, which is smarter than most contestants on Jeopardy. When Frank goes to a meeting, his calls are automatically forwarded to him there. When he goes to lunch, his calls follow him there. They don't show this in the movie, but you get the feeling that Frank also receives calls when he's on the crapper. Needless to say, the movie ends with Frank getting the big contract and breaking the news via conference call to his associates. Presumably, they will celebrate by having their computers send each other hearty electronic handshakes at 17.3 billion vibrations per second. We never find out what happens to the loser, Fred. My guess is that, as a result of not taking advantage of interactive voice and text technology, he loses his job and can't pay his mortgage and winds up living under the interstate in a refrigerator carton. Sometimes when Frank is processing information on his way to work, he pauses for a nanosecond and thinks about trying to get in touch with his old neighbor. But then he realizes with a wistful shake of his head that he can't do this because Fred's carton has no fax machine. Sobered by this story, I moved on to Microsoft's Comdex display, which occupied roughly the same square footage as Connecticut.
The big attraction there was, of course, Windows 95, happy face symbol. A large crowd had gathered in a sort of amphitheater to see a demonstration. It began with a raucous recording of Start Me Up by the Rolling Stones, to whom Microsoft had paid about $1 zillion for the rights to use the song in its commercials. It makes perfect sense. The name Rolling Stones has long been synonymous with 32-bit multitasking graphical user interface operating systems. The Comdex crowd was stiff and serious when Start Me Up began playing. But as the song's raucous guitar lick and infectious pounding beat blared from the big speaker system, the crowd responded by remaining stiff and serious. Your Comdex attendees generally do not appear to be get-down, get-funky individuals. Your Comdex attendees strike me as the kind of people who celebrate New Year's Eve by defragmenting their hard drives. But they perked up when two guys came out to demonstrate Windows 95, happy face symbol. One of the guys, the project manager, stood at a keyboard underneath a giant computer screen. The other guy, Jeff, bounded enthusiastically around the audience describing Windows 95, happy face symbol, via modern hipster lingo such as, "We're really jammin'." Jeff was especially excited about the taskbar. The taskbar. And here I will get technical for a moment. The taskbar is this thing that Windows 95 has. You use it to enhance your productivity by switching quickly from one program to another. For example, if I'm utilizing the missile command program and I suddenly develop a need to utilize the Space Cadet pinball program, all I have to do is click on the taskbar and bang, there I am with almost no wasted time. Jeff was wetting his pants over the taskbar. "No more Alt-Tab switching," he was declaring, in the tone of voice you might use to announce a cure for cancer, and the crowd was nodding. Think of it. No more Alt-Tab switching. Whew. The scary thing is, I was nodding. As a Windows 95 taskbar user and former Alt-Tab switcher, I knew exactly what they were talking about. I was definitely getting in touch with my inner geek here. The rest of the crowd was also getting excited, especially when Jeff and the project manager had a dramatic confrontation over the hardware configuration. What happened was Jeff accused the project manager of using some kind of souped-up system to make Windows 95 look good. So the project manager, accepting the challenge, used his mouse to boldly click on his control panel icon, then his system icon, and he showed that his computer had a plain old 486 processor, and get ready, only 8 megs of RAM. At this point, I swear, the audience actually applauded. I will admit that even I was moved, fearing that if I stood in this crowd any longer, I would spontaneously develop a pocket pen holder. I moved on. Nearby, a group of San Francisco 49ers cheerleaders were helping promote the information revolution by sitting at a table and autographing calendars while a line of guys tried to look down the fronts of their uniforms. A dozen yards past that was a booth where a woman in a short, tight skirt approached everybody who walked past and said in a sultry voice, "Client server?" I'm not sure what she meant by this, but I steered clear of her because this is exactly the kind of situation in which a guy can pick up a virus. I did, however, stop to watch a demonstration of virtual reality, which is when you use a computer to simulate the real world. The advantage of this is that virtual reality can be better than the real world because in your virtual world you can eliminate all traces of, to pick one obvious example, Deion Sanders. At Comdex, the Mitsubishi company had set up a virtual park, which was this computer-created space where real people would go and interact via computer, even though their physical bodies were miles apart. The audience could watch them on a giant screen. They looked like cartoon figures without necks, so their heads were hovering over their bodies. They were bicycling and jogging around the park, chatting with each other and interacting in a jovial manner until they were attacked by virtual muggers. I'm kidding again, of course. Everything was swell in the virtual park, and it got me to thinking about the tremendous potential of virtual reality. Think of the social advantages. The real you
could be a total bucket of flab, sitting at home eating Cheese Whiz directly from the jar, while the virtual you could be a hard-bodied cyber stud, jogging through the virtual park, meeting hot virtual babes via clever pickup lines. Man. Hi there. My head is not attached to my body. Woman. Well, neither is mine. Let's have virtual sex. Man. Okay. They remove their virtual clothes. Woman. Wow, that's a big virtual penis. Man. Yes, I can make it any size you want. 50 feet long, for example. Woman. No, thanks. Man. Hey, who's that running toward us? Woman. Uh-oh, it's my virtual husband with a virtual gun. Man, I thought you said he was at work. Husband, I am at work. And this is just one example of how virtual reality can help enhance our lives. There are countless other scenarios. For example, the day will come when you no longer have to attend weddings in person. You'll just stay at home and travel via computer to a cyber chapel where you will watch as bridesmaids, who may be thousands of miles away, walk down the virtual aisle wearing identical ugly virtual dresses. Or you will attend a virtual funeral where you can say your last goodbye to the virtual corpse, which, depending on the funeral software package the family has selected, might even wave back at you. Yes, there's an amazing virtual future ahead for us. But in two areas of human endeavor, the incredible potential of virtual reality is already being realized. Naturally, since we're talking about a technology developed primarily by guys, these two areas of human endeavor are 1. Playing games. 2. Looking at naked women. There are some very high-tech computer games on display at Comdex. This is a place where games are taken seriously. You'd see businessmen wearing dark suits and wingtip shoes, frowning with intense business-like concentration as they fought mutant killer androids from the Death Planet. Most of these action games work the same way. You have to keep killing the enemy units until they're all dead, at which point you move on to the next level, where you have to kill more enemy units, and so on until you reach the last level and face the final challenge, which is a fight to the death against the maximum Doom Lord, with the winner getting the ultimate prize, which is presumably a cab at Comdex. These games never offer the option of negotiation or compromise. You can't say to the mutant killer androids, hey, why are we always killing each other? Why don't we all just put down our weapons and enjoy some refreshing virtual beverages? But that isn't the way guys design games. I suspect that if women designed these games, there would be a lot more social interaction. You'd be wandering through the dark maze-like basement of the Castle of Terror, lost, and as you came around a corner, you'd encounter this grotesque, insect-like, slime-dripping, multi-eyed creature, but instead of shooting at it, you'd say, excuse me, I'm lost. And the creature, pleasantly surprised to finally meet somebody whose immediate reaction was not to obliterate it, would use one of its 28 arms to direct you toward the exit. The next thing you knew, the two of you would be chatting away, and the creature would be showing you photographs of its larva. But that's not how guys design games. In the vast majority of the games I saw at Comdex, the only type of interaction allowed was shooting. Or worse. At one point, I stood with a group of suited, wing-tipped businessmen and watched a young man demonstrate a game wherein you control this very lifelike-looking android as it fought with various enemy units. At one point, the young man directed the android into a tunnel where it got too close to a huge whirling fan, which sucked the struggling android toward it, slowly at first, then faster and faster, until finally the android says, quote, shit! And then gets sucked through the fan blades like a giant android zucchini going through a giant Vegematic. The computer screen then showed us the other side of the fan where android pieces came shooting out in highly realistic detail covered with purple android blood. We onlookers winced in unison. The young man demonstrating the game turned to us and said with sincere pride, is that rude or what? At another Comdex booth, run by a company called Fort Technologies, I tried a virtual reality game featuring a head-mounted display, or HMD. This is basically a helmet with a set of goggles containing two little computer screens, one for each eyeball, so that you feel as though you're inside the computer game. The images are in 3D, and you control what you're looking at by turning your head. In my hand, I held a cyber puck, which was a little round thing that I could tilt and rotate to move through the game. The game I played was called Dark Forces, and it involved, prepare yourself for a big surprise, trying to kill evil enemy units. When you're inside this game, running around blasting the bad guys with your laser gun, leaping tall buildings at a single bound, you feel pretty cool. What you don't realize is that from the outside, you look like a dork in a silly helmet waving a puck around. But if you want to look really ridiculous playing at a computer game, the game you need to check out is Cyber Smut. This is getting to be a pretty big industry. In fact, at the same time as Comdex was going on, there was another trade show in Las Vegas, creatively named Adultdex, devoted entirely to sexually explicit computer stuff. According to its press release, Adultdex was started to provide a home for exhibitors who had been banned from Comdex. The release also stated, apparently without trying to be funny, that the industry takes in over $3 billion a year in gross income. As a dedicated research professional, I decided to visit Adultdex, which was held at the Sahara Hotel, a convenient 850-mile walk from the main convention center. At first glance, Adultdex looked like a much smaller version of Comdex. You had your exhibitor booths. You had your badge-wearing guys wandering around looking at products. The big difference was that the products in these exhibits were not designed to give you access to vast quantities of productivity-enhancing information. These products were designed to give you access to pictures of naked women. In addition to the computerized women, some of the Adultdex booths featured actual human women made of flesh and blood, plus an estimated average of 34 pounds of silicone apiece. There was one woman walking around accompanied by the largest pair of breasts I personally have ever seen. Any given one of these breasts would, in most cities, require a zoning variance. But the weird thing was, the badge-wearing guys seemed to be less interested in the real women than in the computerized women. At the first booth I came to, a small crowd had gathered to watch a guy operate a CD-ROM. CD-ROM is a group of initials. Computer game. Where the goal was to get the woman on the screen. Most of these games feature video footage of women. To undress. The man, using the mouse, clicked on the woman's various body parts. If he clicked on the right part, the woman would say things like, "Oh, yes," and remove some item of clothing. But if you clicked on the wrong place, she'd say, "What kind of girl do you think I am?" And the game would be over. The crowd watched solemnly as the guy clicked away, trying to get the woman to take off her brassiere. He was frowning with concentration, looking for all the world as though he were performing a particularly tricky type of brain surgery. I don't want to get too heavily philosophical here, but the sad truth is that this game perfectly reveals how a lot of guys wish that sexual relationships really worked. You just click in the right place and bingo, score. No need for all that talking. A few steps away was an exhibitor offering a chance to see a new 3D computer sex game. There was a line of serious-looking, badge-wearing guys waiting to get into a little enclosed booth. From the inside of the booth came the recorded sounds of women in the throes of feigned orgasmic passion. "Oh, oh, yeah, ah, ah, yeah, 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 yes," and so on. I didn't go into the booth, so I don't know what the specific cause of the moaning was. Perhaps the women had just discovered an exciting new function of the Windows 95 taskbar. A few yards away, I overheard a conversation between two serious-looking, suit-wearing exhibitors, apparently talking about some new product. "Are they X-rated or what?" one of them said. "Oh, they're really dancing on the line," said the other. "I mean, I definitely saw insertion." At another booth, I watched as an extremely nerdy exhibitor, and I'm talking about a guy who makes Bill Gates look like Brad Pitt, enthusiastically demonstrated a CD-ROM program to a businessman with a foreign accent. This program allowed you to direct your own porno movie. You'd pick your kind of scenes you wanted, and the computer would somehow splice them together.
Okay,
said the nerd, moving his computer mouse around the screen, very proud of his program, talking about it the way you'd talk about a new word processor.
You go to your menu here, and you can pick anything you want. Regular sex, three-way pussy-eating, anal, anal with dildo, whatever.
To illustrate his point, he clicked on the anal with dildo menu item, and sure enough, there it was on the screen, anal with dildo in color. The foreign businessman looked impressed.
This is a new frontier, he said.
Indeed it is. And from the looks of things at adult decks, it's only the beginning, as the hardware and software, insert your own clever hardware and software double entendres here, continue to evolve. This fast-growing billion-dollar industry will undoubtedly come up with newer and better ways to help losers whack off. And to think that just a few decades ago there was nothing but National Geographic. Yes, a brighter day is indeed dawning. That is what I was thinking as I left adult decks and began the death march back to the total lack of quality in. Whether we're ready or not, computers are rapidly changing our lives in every area. Not just smut, but also business, communications, medicine, education, government, and sucking androids through fans. The people at Comdex are on the cutting edge of this change. Their ideas, their products, and their visions have the potential to make the world a very different place for the rest of us. So it's probably just as well that, what with the taxi situation, most of them will never make it back to the airport. Chapter 6. Software. Making your computer come alive so it can attack you. Once you've determined what kind of computer you need, answer, some computer other than the one you actually have, you must decide what kind of software to run on it. Without software, a computer is just a lump of plastic, whereas with software, it's a lump of plastic that can permanently destroy critical data. What is software? Really, it's nothing more than a series of instructions called a program that a computer follows. For example, the program that controls your bank's ATM machine probably looks something like this. 1. Display message. Welcome to Interteller. Please insert card. 2. Upon card insertion, display message. Please enter password and press enter. 3. After customer enters password and presses enter, wait 45 seconds, then display message. Welcome to Interteller. Please insert card. 4. When customer has pushed every button 50 times and has forehead veins throbbing like crazed bait, display message, thank you for using Interteller. Have a nice day. 5. Send card to card melter. Of course, this is an extremely simple program. Modern software is capable of handling far more complex tasks. In fact, as the brains of your computer, software has become so smart that it can perform many of the functions that your brain performs, including gathering information, weighing options, making decisions, getting nervous, lying, forgetting where you left the car keys, and fantasizing about addressing an Amway convention naked. In fact, modern software has become so sophisticated that it can actually think as well as human beings, and perhaps even better. This was proven beyond any doubt in the historic series of chess matches played between world champion Garry Kasparov and an IBM supercomputer named Deep Blue. Although the other chess-playing computers, when they are hanging out in the locker room, call it by its jocular nickname, RPX 503949632343546. The series came down to one final game, and Kasparov, displaying the brilliantly unconventional attacking strategy that most experts thought would give him an insurmountable advantage over any machine, appeared to have won. But Deep Blue,
which is capable of analyzing 200 million possible moves per second, pondered what appeared to be a hopeless situation, and then, in one of the most dramatic reversals in the history of chess, sent an estimated 45,000 volts of electricity into Kasparov's body. Unethical, you say? A flagrant violation of the rules? Fine. Let's see you explain that to Deep Blue, who, by the way, has branched out to other games and is now the undisputed world champion in checkers, Monopoly, chutes and ladders, arm wrestling, and Tickle-Dee. Fortunately, you probably will not have to deal with software at this level of sophistication, but you will have to learn how to install and attempt to use it. So let's review the software basics, starting with what kind of software you need. First off, you need an operating system, which is the godfather program that operates behind the scenes, telling all the other programs what to do, making sure they cooperate, and if necessary, leaving the heads of virtual horses in their beds. The most popular operating system in the world as of 10:30 a.m. today is Windows 95, happy face symbol. But there are many other options, including Windows 3.1, Windows 3.11, Windows 3.111, Windows for workgroups, Windows for groups that mainly just screw around, Windows for repeat offenders, low-fat Windows, and the artist formerly known as Windows. There is also the old MS-DOS operating system, which is actually written on parchment and is rarely used on computers manufactured after the French and Indian War. And there is OS 2, which was developed at enormous expense by IBM and marketed as a Windows alternative, and which has won a loyal following of thousands of people, an estimated three of whom do not work for IBM. And, of course, there is the Apple operating system, or Apple operating system for your hippie, beatnik, weirdo, loner, narcotics-ingesting, communistic types of Apple-owning individuals who are frankly too wussy to handle the challenge of hand-to-hand combat with computer systems specifically designed to thwart them.
So, there are many different operating systems available, each with different capabilities, advantages, and drawbacks. Which one is right for your specific needs? The answer is, whichever one is already on your computer. Believe me, you do not want to try to install a new operating system yourself. I have done this several times, and it is terrifying. Your computer is taken over by an evil demon installation program, very much the way the young Linda Blair was taken over in the movie The Exorcist. First your screen goes blank, and then suddenly your computer starts asking you a series of questions that you could never answer in a million years, like, the installation program has determined that a conflict exists between your IRQ port parameter module and your cache initialization valve. Shall the installation program reallocate the motherboard transfer polarity replication allotment, or shall it adjust the disk controller impedance threshold? Bear in mind that if you answer this question incorrectly, all of your data will be lost and innocent people could die. And before it will proceed any further with the installation program wishes you to name the capital of Cameroon. And how many men are in your unit? What is your objective? What is your radio frequency? What is the password? Answer, the installation program has ways to make you talk. This can go on for many hours, and at any moment your computer may start laughing in a diabolical manner and spinning its monitor around 360 degrees and projectile vomiting green stuff. Your newer multimedia computers vomit in a variety of colors. I remember a couple of years ago when my son Rob, in an act of great bravery, attempted to install the OS 2 operating system, which came in the form of about 8,000 diskettes accompanied by a manual the size of a Toyota Camry. And the computer was working fine when Rob started. After several hours of installation, it was a totally dysfunctional, muttering, potentially violent thing, and we had to take it outside and shoot it. Actually, since this happened in Miami, all we really had to do was take it outside where passing motorists shot it. So the bottom line is you should stick with the operating system you have now. But there are many other exciting programs that you can put on your computer's hard drive. As you're deciding which ones you want, always remember that the ultimate purpose of all software is to provide you with a sufficient level of computing power so that your hard drive gets filled up and you need to buy a new computer. Here are some of the basic programs that everybody should have. A word processor. See Chapter 8 for more information on how you can use word processing to make your ordinary-looking documents much longer. There are many excellent word processors available, including Word, Word Perfect, Word Barely Adequate, Big Word, Bad Word, and Word for Non-Spellers. You should get a full-featured word processor defined as a word processor that has thousands of functions that you will never have any conceivable use for. A good rule of thumb is, if it takes you about 3 weeks of practicing 8 hours a day before you can successfully type and print out a simple sentence, then you have a full-featured word processor. Also, it goes without saying that any word processor you purchase, and here I speak on behalf of literally tens of thousands of experienced writing professionals, must be able to make a line of italic squirrels.